My name is Dick Hilden. The name of this session is, To What End Do We Worship Competency? This is the fourth in a series of five on technology that we've had this week. On Saturday, we're going to have another session entitled Living Humanly in a Technological Society. And I'm going to add also in that title, And Humanely, in view of some of the things that we have talked about with Leo Bustead. I think that emphasis is also of some appropriateness. To what end do we worship competency?
A story. A story is being told that there was a scientist recently who had the idea that he wanted to ask the question, what is God, or is there a God? And he wanted to ask that question of his computer at his university. And so he programmed asked the question, directed his question to his university computer, is there a God? And the computer churned and chunked and whirled and steamed and fused and fussed and came back with a response, I cannot compute the answer to that question. Well, the scientist took the next logical step, which scientists tend to do, and that is to say we need more computer power to answer this question. And so he determined that he would network four or five of the larger computers that he knew, which were locally at other colleges and other facilities, and that this surely would be sufficient to give some answer to the question. And he did, and he entered into the machine the question, is there a God? And again, the machine fumed and fussed and churned and whirled and cranked, and part of the problem was looked at in Oregon State, another at Berkeley, and the response came back, I'm unable to compute the answer to this question. So the scientist again decided to seek to get more computer power, and so he got on the network that connects all of the major computers, with a few exceptions, in the entire world. And again he asked the question, entered the question into the computer system, is there a God? And things were whirling all over the world. In Brussels, one computer, just a massive one, was working on part of the problem. In Stockholm, another one. In Cleveland, another one, aspect of the problem. And he was startled by the answer he finally saw on his video screen. The answer was, now there is. With that kind of startling answer, I think we need a little bit of humor, and to do that, Leo Bustead has given me some slides that I think are very, very fun to look at and speak to this. Do you know how to switch that on? Is the switch all the way up? I think it's... Now there is. And here we see the computer at the top of the mountain with us people moving up to it to worship it. It's good to be able to laugh sometimes at these things. And there have been different responses on the part of people to computers. Here we see one. And I'm going to describe it so that the people listening on the tape would know. It shows Leo Bustead was his associate, and it says, Dean Bustead, the computer says you've been kicking it. And we see Leo here with a cast on his leg. And there have been other responses. Here we see a computerized dog, and the computer is responding on its video screen to Leo, stupid, pet the dog. And we see a common response on the part of Leo, and that is to find the power switch for this machine and turn it off. And he is about to switch off the computer. And others have resorted to more primitive techniques. This is a Norwegian computer calculator. It shows five fingers protruding up through five holes, and there are various instructions there with regard to how to use that instrument to do calculations. And others have resorted to even more primitive techniques. Here we see Leo leaning against a large hourglass, and an associate has his arm around his shoulder, and he's saying, "I'm glad to see someone else put off by computer digital watches." And even the animals are revolting against some of the technology that is being implemented today. And here we see a raging bull taking off after Leo Buchet, and in his hand he has a valise that says AI on it, which stands for artificial insemination. Well, Leo tells me that this also could stand for artificial intelligence. Another raging technology these days. And there are even some of us that have simply come out and wanted to step out altogether. And here we see a chick that is coming out of his egg, looks at what he sees in the world, and decides to go back into the egg again. So there are many, many forms of responses to this new technology, or the technologies that we have today, and here you've seen some of them. Here are a couple of other situations in which we find ourselves. Leo, and we talked about this joke the other day, Leo is on the phone, he is obviously having difficulty with his computer system, and he is saying to the person on the other end, "It would certainly be a lot easier, Mrs. Lesk, if you would pay the $8,240 bill for staying your cat than for us to find the error in our computer." And it would probably be cheaper. Yeah. And here we see Leo being addressed by his video terminal from the computer. "Try again, idiot." And finally, the message, "Clean out your desk, turn in your key." And in this one, we see Leo walking dejectedly by a cage with monkeys in it. And the comments from the monkey, one to the other, is, "There was a time when they too were waited on, served food and drink, and had their homes cleaned by servants." And implying that the computers are moving in. And another slide that Leo gave me, a statement by Einstein, which I think conveys the message. Einstein wanted to convey a message to his fellow scientists, and perhaps it speaks to all of us, in that we all are, to a certain degree, involved in this highly technological age of ours. It might not seem that way at Holden, but as we go back to our cities, and we will feel that way. The statement is, "Concern for man himself and his fate must always form the chief interest of all technical endeavors. Never forget this in the midst of your diagrams and equations, in order that the creations of our mind shall be a blessing, not a curse to mankind." Could you turn that off now? Thank you for that. I love Leo's chamber. And in this day and age, we need that so badly. We need to laugh.
Where do all the cartoons come from?
Well, he thinks of those himself. I'm sorry?
Does he draw them?
No, he has someone else draw them for him. Maybe the computer does. Wouldn't that be a switch? Yes, I will. I will try to speak loudly so that we can all hear. So we come to the question, or at least I would raise the question, to what end do we worship competency? To what ends are we striving through this
this rapid, almost religious fervor we have over wanting to progress. To be sure, many marvelous things have taken place as a result of our technology. We know that health care has greatly extended the lives of persons and has prevented the premature death of many people and many children throughout the world. And technology has provided the means, at least the possibility, for us to be able to feed the entire world. Technology has provided the possibility for being able to provide pure water for all persons in the world. And the blessings, or the potential blessings of technology, are vast. As we know. Attendant with that, however, is the responsibility that we need to look at, with a sense of responsibility and compassion, at some of the attendant bad things that attended as well. We spoke a couple days ago how it was unavoidable that with every new technology, there is the potential for good and bad. I think of Leo's experiment with the human-animal bond. I was just very moved by the picture of the young prison woman who was in prison for some, I think it was as a contract killer, and she had the dog with her, probably representing one of the last links of trust that she might have with any creature. Very difficult, I'm sure, for her to be able to place her trust in a human being, although not possible. But through the techniques that Leo is looking at, that woman then does have a relationship of faith. And I would count that as a responsible, a compassionate use of technology, one in which technology becomes a blessing. I think we have the responsibility to look at where we have progressed and where we are going with regard to technology, and to make sure, or at least to the extent that we can influence it, see to it that technology is the blessing, and not the curse, that is the potential that it has to be that. We need to look, however, sometimes, I think, at what is taking place, and where we have come in this progress that we call it. Theodore Roszak, in his book Where the Wasteland Ends, states that there is a measure by which we can gauge how far we have progressed from our primitive condition, and that measure is the degree to which the environment becomes artificial. Recall one of Jacques Ellul's points the other day, if you were here at the session a couple days ago. He said one of the characteristics of technology is that it is tends toward artificiality, that it introduces artificiality. And we talked about some of the unnatural characteristics of some of the things that we have created with our technology, and I think we need to consider them. We talked about the Metrodome, which is a roof or dome stadium in Minneapolis, which we gather in to watch events, and the King Dome here in Seattle. And we considered the other day that within that place, there isn't one natural thing that you can lay your eyes on, with the possible exception of the mound of dirt that the picture pitches from, which, as we talked about the other day, is clean dirt. And we have many things like this that tend to be highly artificial. I love to go to Disney World and Epcot Center. But I also have lingering in the back of my mind at the artificiality that we enjoy in that place. And I think that we need to be aware of that and some of the consequences of our pursuit along those lines. I just a few minutes ago mentioned artificial intelligence. The fifth generation of computers are in the offing. Japan has proclaimed to the world, and now I'm quoting an article from one of my technical journals, so I'll simply read it. Japan has proclaimed to the world within 10 years it will develop and market the fifth generation machines, that is computers. These computers will surpass today's machines by a factor of over 1,000. They claim that these machines will demonstrate artificial intelligence with reasoning power, with power to draw conclusions, make judgments, and understand the written and spoken word. Edgar Feinenbaum and Pamela McCormick, who have recently written a book entitled The Fifth Generation, have stated with regard to these machines that they will shift the very cornerstone of our society, will affect the basic quality of our lives, and will change the way we think about ourselves as intelligent beings. So we can see the vast implications of this. And one of the points of the book, I might add, is that it raises then the issue about whether the United States shouldn't also do this in order that it not be offset by what is happening in Japan. And we see almost just a very regenerative sort of thing taking place here, where we're moving so rapidly into these areas. I'd like to talk just a minute with regard to some of our defense posture in this country. We are looking now at what is called the force multiplier effect. That is, the United States being able to develop such sophisticated machines that we will be able to instantaneously compute where dangers exist within the world, and we will be able to move in there with relatively small weapons and stamp them out. That's called a force multiplier effect, where we are essentially using this high intelligence, so to speak, in order to concentrate the thrust of certain weapons. And this needs to be considered from the viewpoint of all of us, I think. In that regard, I would like to read from Scientific American. It's an article entitled Science and the Citizen, and it talks about, let me just read it. Perhaps the most poignant aspect of the report by the President's Commission on Strategic Forces, that is the Snowcross Commission report, is the implicit acknowledgement that in retrospect, the U.S. decision of a decade or so ago to begin deploying multiple independently targetable reentry vehicles, sometimes we call them MIRVs, on the nation's land-based strategic missiles was a mistake. It was a mistake to develop them, according to the Snowcross Commission. The destabilizing effect on the strategic balance of highly accurate, counter-force-capable multi-warhead missiles, isn't that a mouthful, has come to be generally recognized by the U.S. military planners only after the USSR followed the American lead and installed MIRVs on its long-range missiles, thereby threatening the land-based component of the U.S. deterrent forces. Even our military planners are saying we need a station going that far. Shouldn't we simply as people, and certainly as Christians, raise questions like that with all the vigor we can? Going on, the response of the Snowcross group, that was an editorial comment, incidentally, for those on tape, but that was not in this article. So let me continue. The response of the Snowcross group and others is to advise that the U.S. now plan to revert ultimately to a single warhead missile nicknamed Midget Man and try to persuade the Russians to do the same. In the words of former National Security Advisor McGeorge Bundy, the introduction of MIRV technology ranks as the United States' worst single contribution to the nuclear arms race. The mistake is about to be repeated in the view of many long-term students of the arms race. This time, however, the major technological initiative in question is the imminent introduction of a new generation of anti-satellite, or ASAT, weapons. According to a petition prepared earlier this year by Richard L. Garwin and Carl Sagan, and signed by more than 40 prominent American physicists, space scientists, and defense experts, the testing or deployment of any weapons in space, including anti-satellite weapons, significantly increases the likelihood of warfare on Earth. The petition sent to the leaders of all space-faring nations with an independent launch capability calls for the prompt adoption of a treaty prohibiting the extension of the arms race to space, noting that if space weapons are ever to be banned, this may be close to the last moment in which it can be done. Those are hard words to read, And I think that I have a tendency, and maybe you've experienced it as well, to not want to deal with that sort of thing. And yet, isn't our responsibility in today's world, if we are to responsibly and compassionately look at what is happening, isn't it part of it to look at that issue? A couple of statistics, and I don't want to dwell on these too long. We get them often, but I think there are some things that stand in juxtaposition here that are good for us to focus on sometimes. Since World War II, the United States has spent approximately $2.5 trillion on the military. 20-30% of all the scientists and engineers in the country are employed by the defense sector, and some say as high as 50%. A point I would raise there, I mentioned before that we have the possibility to provide pure water for all the people in the world. 3/5 of the people in the world, as I understand it, do not have pure water. 3/5 of the world are not drinking pure water. It is estimated that it would require $400 billion investment by the countries of the world in order to solve that. $400 billion, which is somewhat less than the total defense budget of all the countries in the world for a year. And it raises a question, I think. In his farewell address as president, Dwight Eisenhower delivered a warning to the American people. He said that World War II and the development of the atomic bomb had transformed the United States into a strong but vulnerable world leader. And he said, we have been compelled to create a permanent arms industry of vast proportions. In the councils of government, we must guard against the acquisition of unwarranted influence, whether thought or unthought, by the military-industrial complex. The potential for the disastrous rise of misplaced power exists and will persist. Today, the jobs of 1 out of 10 Americans depend upon defense spending, and perhaps all of us do, in a sense. Proposed plans for U.S. defense spending are $1.8 trillion over the next 5 years. $1.8 trillion. One quarter of that is the estimated investment which would be required to bring pure water to all people in the world. With regard to the distribution of wealth during the heavy period of technological advancement, this comment. In 1900, people in poor countries had a per capita income about 1/2 of that of the people in rich nations. By 1970, it was about 1/20 of that of the rich nations measured in $1,900, and the gap widened. And in other places, we see the point to which we have come. We talked about this the other day, the acid rain problem. Sulfur dioxide and nitric oxide from smokestacks are such that it's estimated that 20,000 of the 1,000 lakes in Sweden are dead of fish. It's estimated that by 1985, Sweden will spend $40 million per year in order to limit or in order to restock its lakes, some of them. The article also pointed out, from which I got this, that there have always have been acid rains. There have been volcanoes and other natural events that have caused acid rains to exist, but it's only been a problem in the last 200 years. Normally, the environment has been able to accommodate the acid rain caused by natural sources, but since the Industrial Revolution 200 years ago, the problem has become the almost gargantuan one it is today. Here's a statistic that is just amazing, particularly in view of Art and Doris's presentation on Mount St. Helens. Listen to this. Today, a large coal-fired power plant can emit in a single year as much sulfur dioxide as blown out by Mount St. Helens in 1980. 400,000 tons of it in a single year. This group is always so good at discussions that I'm going to jump ahead and offer a question for discussion relating to this, rather than dwell on more of the statistics of that type. I think we all hear them over and over again, and I think we need to be about the process of considering them. I'd like to address this question of competency. To what ends have we worshipped competency? And I want to talk about education for a few moments. I'm not an expert in this, but would make a few observations, almost casual ones. Matthew Fox talks about the fact that our education system is not so much education, that is, preparing us and our children to go out in the world to have visionary thoughts, but rather than our system is more inducation, that is, to prepare us, to bring us into the system and to support the system that we have. And I get a sense of appropriateness in what he is saying if we think about that for a minute. Perhaps we don't prepare ourselves and our children to be visionary. I spent some time in Nicaragua this last year and was somewhat set back by a statement that I heard, and I would like to share it with you. I had a chance with the group I was with to interview the head of what is the equivalent of the Chamber of Commerce in Nicaragua, the head of the private sector, the head of an organization that represents various corporate interests within Nicaragua, which I would hasten to say are doing business very well in that country. And we asked him directly, what do you find objectionable to in the revolutionary government now of Nicaragua? And he listed a number of things which I considered to be valid, you know, comments or criticisms of the government, which the government also acknowledges. But he made this statement which stuck in my head because it might be a statement that I would make. He said that the revolutionary government in Nicaragua is now providing literacy training for all the people in the country, but their emphasis is on quantity of education and not on quality of education. And I thought, now that's a statement I might have made. But when viewed in the perspective of the fact that perhaps the situation is that many of us are becoming highly educated, are receiving first-class quality education, but perhaps at the expense of many, many, many other people throughout the world who aren't receiving any education. And it occurred to me that maybe I needed to look just at what this was costing, that is, my education and the education that we tend to have so high on a pedestal in our country, what that might be costing other persons throughout the world, and that maybe we needed to look at that through some other glasses. You know, it's said over and over again now that we are entering the information era. The third wave is the information era. And the economists need to deal with the fact that information is power. That's the way it's considered in economics. Information is power. It is an asset. And to what extent, I would ask, are we holding the assets and not sharing with our sisters and brothers elsewhere? I raise that question. I don't know how much integrity there is to the question, but I raise it sort of as one who has just been confronted almost in a casual way with that through that response of that man in Nicaragua. My business partner says that if we don't do something about this, that is the point at which some of us are getting so much of the information and so much of the technology, he said that one half of us are going to spend our vacations on Venus while the other half of us starve to death. And I would also hasten to say that technology that is not considered with compassion tends to move in that direction of separating the technologically elite, of which we are all a part in this country, over and against those that do not have access to it. A few years ago in our congregation in Minneapolis, we conducted a survey to ask questions about the extent to which persons were able to become integrated into the congregational life. And I was struck by two, three, or four responses of people which indicated that they felt that it was difficult for them to enter into the life of our congregation because they didn't feel competent enough. And what they saw was a level of professionalism in the way we live our lives in our congregation, such that they didn't feel they were a part of it. And while that doesn't represent a very significant poll of feelings of people, I came to suspect that maybe that, in fact, is something that we need to consider. That is, have we made our society, our institutions, our communities even, such that we exclude people because we have an image of competency in this place? I think it would just raise a question for me. And so I would like to place this question before this group, which loves to discuss, if the last few sessions have been any indication. Have we placed competency by our common standards, by the things by which I think that we gauge them by in our society, have we placed it on a pedestal to worship it? And has it become an idol for us? Has it become an end in itself in our society, even in our institutions, of education, entertainment, and church itself? I would offer that as a question for discussion here this morning. And I'll stop talking for a while, and I'd like to hear some.
The last few words, you provoke one very specifically in a certainly answer the question. The United States, I don't know how unique the United States is, but the United States is just absolutely taken with its position of winning. The question of the bulletin board is along the lines of, are we considering the competency? Are we really taken by it? Are there any interpretations? In a sense, an answer is no. We couldn't care less. We are not impressed awfully popularly, of course. This means we live in the age of entertainment, or if you will, secondary activity, as opposed to doing it in oneself. If they say that the number two flute player, basket weaver, whatever it is coming to town, who's going to hear what he has to say or see what he can do? Number two is almost a debasing term, and we're breeding a generation that watches the two. And winning is everything. And it doesn't make a difference how you do it. You have to have more points than the other guy.
Wouldn't you say, though, that isn't somewhat of a worship of competency? That, in fact, we aren't happy unless we're watching the best.
Good point. Good argument. What I'm saying is, it's not the actual competency. It's the aura.
The image of it.
Yes.
Yeah. Other comments or questions?
I'm a little puzzled by what the alternative is. If we don't worship incompetency, if we don't worship competency, do we worship incompetency? I mean, what's the alternative?
What kind of responses would your office?
Well, I think
that
we completely are about to compliment. I think making a small hole and not to get a big hole.
Say some more.
I had hoped this would come to me. Instead of trying to find out who is the best, and then the best improving, and the second best, it's eternal record. That's never enough. If a person, if you need to receive a thought for a moment, if a person has a record, can't be the record for the state too long. It has to become a national record. Then it has to become an Olympic record, and then it better become a world record because somebody else is training to reach that goal. The one who set the world record has to jump over his or her own record. It will never stop. It's never a moment of achievement. This is really good. And look around and see what can we do with it now. we take on the self trying to evaluate and apply the Japanese and the in a different field.
Well, I think that shed some light on it. I recall someone that said that a test of whether our actions really reflect the gospel in it is whether it's good news for everyone. And we see in situations where we place the winner on the pedestal, that in fact that kind of action tends to then with the winners or with the losers. And not be particularly good news if, in fact, our worship is of that competency. So in a sense, I think it doesn't quite pass the test. It would seem to me that the goal we might seek in that kind of situation is a win-win situation for everyone. And I guess my response to you would be that the alternative is to not worship competency, but perhaps to change the scale on which we define that competency to be. Yeah.
Okay, one example of an alternative is which is sort of a counterculture to the idea of competency, and unfortunately not available to most of us at the time, is the Special Olympics. And there is a celebration of our theme.
Mm-hmm. Could you describe those for the Special Olympics?
For handicapped. Mentally physically handicapped people, and it's running it's somewhat parallel to the regular Olympics in respect that they do physical activity or of some sort. And yet everyone gets a medal, everyone, the fact that they participate and that they try, they win.
Well, even in that frame of reference, they're all striving to be the best, I think. Mm-hmm. Within the group.
Within yourself. Yeah.
What is the value system associated with those Olympics? What are the things of value there? Did you perhaps?
Well, I see it as a celebration of human life in its total variety, and it definitely does not judge competency except as much as the emphasis on striving and participation and celebration with one another.
Okay, so the striving and participation you would identify as being of high value within that context.
Mm-hmm.
Well,
over and against winning.
It's those boys and girls, a new sense of self-worth.
Mm-hmm. Oh, definitely.
I think putting two times. That, okay, a handicap is what humans think I can overcome it. And secondly, just by seeing I have overcome a handicap who exceeds a self-worth with the two others, I can be just as human as you. And also show another person who is maybe downtown while the handicap is. What person can do is maybe I can too. I see a complementation there, but the commonality instead of, it's almost, I think it's competition. The philosophy is best or worst, that's animosity. And here is the love and mutual support.
Competency more of a relative thing. For instance, you take Albert Schweitzer. The other people have said concerning him quite a way. Because he was a great organist and a great surgeon and doctor. And he wasted his life in Africa, but in the sight of God, there was no more competent person than Albert Schweitzer. So the definition of competence is hard to find.
That's a good point, isn't it? That's a good point. Yeah.
I essentially said part of this yesterday in terms of young people feeling that they can no longer strive to be in the number one position. So that often people give up. And to a certain extent, I think this gentleman is right. They then compensate by worshiping the incompetency among themselves. So, and and destruction rather than creation. I'd like to think that we have to give people the self-worth that says they can do, and I think this is the message I see of Jesus, of validating individuals all over. And we need to, I think, stand back as humans and look at technology and not be frightened of it. I taught a course in Houston Shop with high school students, and I was astounded at what that course did to students. The very concept of looking at what was ahead for humanity frightened them so that they did not do well in that class. When we compared the students in the success rates in that class with students in other classes, they did not do well, I think, basically because they were fearful of their survival in the world of the future. And our whole intention was to say, well, humans are survivors to look at the past, for us to see the past and see that we have survived a great many traumas as human beings and the possibility that we can continue to survive. But in the process of that, we need to esteem ourselves.
I hear some things in tension here. One is this need for striving, for finding the human dignity, for seeking that. And then on the other hand, I hear a statement like yours that Albert Schweitzer took an approach and was considered to be wasteful of those things. And then I hear the story about this alternate Olympics for the handicap, and there are these things in tension. And might it raise the question then that you, I think, were raising, and that is, need we to look at our value system of what competency means? Might it be a question of value with regard to competency? Yes.
I'm raising a question in my mind, but I think that we have the tendency to offset those things naturally. We talked about the mother that had all the doctors around have birth to a child, how do we react? The younger people are proud to have their own natural birth at home with their husband and so forth and so on. That we condemn a car because we don't get it to go every place, people do more walking. And I think we react to those things normally because there are extremes and means, and we see naturally to observe those things without a special big uproar about it, balance it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what I see around me all the time.
We do see those natural tendencies. I wish, however, that we were placed now in the middle of a Pentagon conference room. And I don't want to particularly point to the Pentagon, or to certain corporate boardrooms within our society. And I think our sense wouldn't be quite as strong that we do naturally make those adjustments.
Well, I can give you a point there. Haven't you sensed a big uprising against the missiles? And it's being reflected by our people through their congressmen.
Yeah.
And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if they're going to have trouble of getting more wasteful funds
I affirm that. I think we do too. I affirm what you're saying. The reason that I'm probing it a little bit is that I think we need even more intentionality with regard to this in order for that to take place even more than it is.
My only comment to that is a comment on it. You don't destroy what is good by just seeing something that is bad. You have to evaluate very carefully.
Indeed. I think we're in strong.
More than I blew off my own automobile because of making my way. Yeah.
I think we're in strong agreement. So?
I'm thinking that at this moment, why are these people to business? Why and how? There was a strong reaction among others against human organizations that against the first law on mentality. The business held against people and sensitive and intelligent says no and demonstrated by the magic. And do you remember what society so called reacted to life? It was the teaching, like, you know, that was a bad sentence. And out of the business, the spell of pain, the flower, and the beauty. The same melody and the music. And some remember, I don't know what happened to the hippies, and in the meantime, maybe most of them have realized that rock culture leads them, and it's not the same. Some have wandered off into the rhythms and their tribe, and I think it's the same sensitive, intelligent, and also Christian element that is now rising up against this nuclear. I don't call it these things, I call it fashion, budget, and the discussion which is innate and unavoidable. And I feel that the same thing is, what all you have to do is really keep telling those politicians, if you want to get reelected, I'm not the only one, I speak for so many people, but I think it's the same movement to within this national as well, competitiveness, and judging for competency. So I think you saw your five times, I don't think you saw the second time, but I just saw your first time, how central this judgment. There is an element of sameness and of love coming up too. The judgment is made as the servant of creating your hand office. And I think this is something you see, and that is competency only the same point on the same ground.
Good
afternoon. I think we'd like to live in a form of utopia and see things through rose-colored glasses. But the supremacy we've been talking about or suggested here, there are too many people in the United States that say, we want to be number one. And how are we going to be number one? And how are we going to, are nation going to be number one? By having a lot of military force. How am I individually going to be number one? By having a job. And the economics of the whole situation. So it's not going to be an easy thing for a few people to say, let's pass peace instead.
Getting back to your question about the worth of the comic, I used to umpire Little League. And I think one of the worst things was to see a young boy strike out and then walk with his head hanging to the dugout because his mother or father in the stand was saying, they could have hit it. Or keep your eye on the ball, coaching him all the way back. And you hear and heard so much of that you've got to be competent. And if crying if you strike out because you're not competent is what they really say. So I think we worship competence as a detriment many times of raising our children and also in holding our families together.
There's always a strategy for competency to keep bringing in the engineering line, letting care far up the earth than we used to become good engineers. Japan, likewise, and perhaps Germany. So you've got that constant strategy to keep going forward and educating yourself and becoming competent. But you're in the end of it, really.
One wonders about that. And the build-up now in technological training is going increases very rapidly in the world as a result of what you talked about. Other comments? Now, I'm going to go back to your comments just for a minute. I can...
Yeah.
Ah, okay.
I was wondering, that maxim is one which you guys institutional structures one rises to the level of incompetence.
Mm-hmm.
So that incompetence has something to do with doing a task and fulfilling it, and you rise to the point where you can't do it anymore. Lost in your own limitations. And then with respect to in the Bible, I get constantly, there's this world and there's this thing, and there's this world and there's this thing, and all constantly there's this thing with it. Where we stand in every action. And so competence as a Christian for me entails understanding that with regards to God, I have all competence. I have his competence in viewing me. And that there is no limitation, there is no level of incompetence that I will be. There's always the capacity to say that that beyond me. But on the other hand, there are worldly limitations which I can raise in and develop in and just, you know, face all my life. And there are, well,
and do you see that level of, or that perspective of competency being generally within our society, the one you started with?
Yeah, I think when a man thinks about himself without God in the context, without putting God into the picture, that's all one thing. That we step on top of each other, rise up from the earth, and we're not going anywhere in particular, we're just getting as high as we can.
Mm-hmm. Other comments?
Confidence in the ministry is successful. If you don't move up the corporate ladder, there's something wrong with you, not okay. And you gotta keep going, trying to get confidence.
But the pressures are there.
It is a statement that you keep going up the ladder until you reach the height of incompetence.
Until you reach your level of incompetence, and then you stop.
I think that's how we get caught up in the world system of success and competency. And he was mentioning that that's the world framework. From a Christian standpoint, then Christ asked us not to necessarily be successful, we didn't call us to be successful, but faithful. And in terms of that, he also didn't look at our ability or our capability, even but our availability in any given situation. We tend to develop instead of that, not really realize who we are in Christ and adopt the Christian response that we are, and just for them, we are virtues in through Him. And we can rise above if we will, if our minds will let us be aware of that, we can rise above the world standards and not be caught up in this constant striving and trying to reach the top of the heap.
Good point.
That him, who wants to be great, he is servant of all. But that's what we're often questioning. What does he really adore to strive for? To become a competent servant of all.
Isn't that a well-placed question? Yeah. Would you say that again?
If I can. Jesus says that person who wants to be truly great become the servant of all. And wouldn't it be nice if we could all strive for what that goal to become competent servants of all.
Competent servants of all. That is beautiful.
Our difficulty with competency is that just like anything else, we tend to judge it in our own standard of measurement rather than the Lord.
So maybe we need some new glasses to look at this matter.
What we have is that man-made. Until we bring the Lord into it, by the things that are available to us.
We're close to the end of the hour. But I'm encouraged by I want to make just a comment about Saturday's session where we will talk about living humanly and humanely in a technological society. Part of the thing that we'll deal with there is the thing you mentioned, that the human spirit tends to be resisting this, mm-hmm. and that some of the evidence seems to be that there is life struggling within our society now to resist this. And we're seeing that from many, many places. And it seems to me to be worthwhile to look at that human spirit resisting it and looking at the scales of values that we have as it pertains to competency, and to maybe put on some other glasses and to get at some of the perspectives that have been expressed so beautifully here. Needless to say, as it was also pointed out, that the struggle is going to be very, very great. I mean, those among us, and we're involved in this also, have taken on this other value system very strongly. It will not be an easy thing to shred or shed, I should say, a value system that we have had so strongly ingrained in us. And our whole society needs to be about this process, not just us, but people in the Soviet Union and the whole thing. So we're going to get at that on Saturday. I appreciate so much for being here today and for raising such good questions and discussions. As is usual, the discussion has just been marvelous in these days. I appreciate that.
Are there any tomorrow?
No, tomorrow is a day off, and we will have one on Saturday morning. Thank you very much for being here.